If you say to a man that is absolutely knocking his brains out why you're doing it, he will give you all sorts of explanations about he enjoys the work, he feels it's good, he's thinking of buying a yacht next year, and none of that is true. Why are you knocking your brains out? I am knocking my brains out, working 92 hours a week for $100, because I'm totally stupid. Because I don't understand the world, I don't understand metaphysics. I was taught as a child that making money was hard, that life was hard, okay? And I feel that working hard is honorable. Is there anybody in this room that hasn't heard that? That working hard is honorable? That is the biggest load of horseradish that you've ever heard in your life. But somebody sold you that. And who sold you that working hard is honorable? The guy that wanted you to do the work. Right? Absolutely. There's no other person there. So when you showed up at the office, they gave you this working hard is honorable stuff. What happens if you walked in and you gave them your true feelings? I don't like working hard. Work's a four-letter word. I don't like it. I'm really not into it. I'll be happy to be the sales director for the Northern Territories, but I'm only coming in Thursday. And not every Thursday. But we buy the mindset of the mother and father. We buy the mindset of the family, the lesser members of the family, the more distant members, auntie, uncles, and so on. We buy the mindset of the society, whether you're Jewish or Italian or Australian or English or Spanish or French. Each one of those has a particular form of restriction that is neat. That is neat. And you choose as a higher self that form. You put in for, let me be Sicilian, because I really need to understand emotion. You know, I really need to understand emotion. How do you understand emotion? You understand emotion by spending a whole lifetime fighting. Okay? And that's how you get to understand emotion. And the way Sicilians love each other is they punch each other out. Okay? I know, because I'm half Sicilian. Did I ever tell you the story about my mum? Oh, I've got to tell you. My mother was Sicilian. And she was this very effervescent character that was either laughing or crying. There was no in between, you know? She was either laughing or crying. And when we lived in Africa, we used to have a cook. And the cook came from, like, literally, I mean, he came from the bush. He walked barefoot, like 200 miles to come and be a cook with us. Okay, he was a wonderful, loving, incredibly neat guy that did the very best he could. But what did he know about fettuccine and gnocchi and vermicelli? You know? He knew that the boggy woggy bird flies at dawn, you know. He knows that goat's turds on the path means it's Christmas or whatever he learns in the bush, right? What he knew about this stuff was nothing. So my mother diligently showed him the ins and outs of how tagliatelle is put together. And he would try, and he would get 60 to 70 or 80, depending on his mood, of it right. But it would really, really rattle my mother that these foods was not created correctly. Because to a Sicilian, food and emotion are in the same bag, you know? There's no differentiation between lunch and punching out your best mate. It's more or less the same event. And usually what they do is, to save time of you having to have lunch at your place and then going around and punching out your auntie across the street, you get the auntie to come for lunch and you punch them out together, right? Okay. Working with this energy pattern, in comes Owusu with this food, and my mother used to go nuts. So she was having a very trying time in her life, and one day she picked up this plate of food, and she flung it straight out the window. The food, the lot, you know? I mean, it was just like sort of potato on a parabola, right, heading off to the garden, you know? And the vermicelli going off here and whatever else. Okay. So it was quite a dramatic event, but that was the way my mum was. So 2 or 3 days later, she had another crisis of this, accepting the way this guy cooked the food, and out goes this plate through the window again. Shum! Second time in a week. Well, she did this 3 or 4 or 5 times, I can't exactly remember, over a period of 3 months. We would be sitting waiting for lunch, the steward would ring the bell, the cook would come in with his silver salver with all his nonsense on it, my mum would take one look at it, she'd go, ah, in Sicilian, and she'd throw the grub out the window. So one day, Owusu knew that he'd absolutely, totally ballsed up the lunch. I mean, like this meal that he prepared, whatever it was like this gastronomical Harry Carey, right? And he knew that he was in deep trouble, okay? So, lunch is up, so the steward dings the little bell, And Wooster's like shaking in the kitchen because he knows that he is dead meat on this occasion. I mean, this thing looks horrendous. Something went wrong with the mixing of this and this earlier on, and there's no way to resurrect this to make it look like the way Sicilians want whatever they want. So what he does is he ceremoniously walks into the dining room with the steward, and the steward leads out, and the Wooster's coming with his plate with his food on it, right? And then he puts the food on the dresser, and before he serves it to my mother or any of the family members so we can inspect this gastronomic horrendous thing, right? He ceremoniously walked over to the dining room window, and he opened the window, right? So he stands at his dining room window, and he looks at my mother, and he says, "Can I serve the lunch now?" So we all start laughing, and actually that was a very large, that my mother never threw anything else out the window after that, because we all realised that that was ridiculous, you know? Keep throwing this stuff out. But anyway, if you incarnate with Sicilian, what you incarnate is, you incarnate into emotion. You know, if you incarnate, say, German, you incarnate into analytical, you know, organisational. It's a way you deal with, like, mentality. Okay, if you incarnate Jewish, say, you come to be in the Jewish nation to experience restriction. You know, you look at it and you say, "What's going on there?" And they say, "There's all sorts of nonsense there, mate. I mean, you wouldn't believe what kind of regulations they've got about living and not living and what you can do and what you can't do. On top of that, there's a whole bunch of people trying to blow them up. Try that, you know?" So you say, "Fine." And you say, "Well, it looks nice and sunny." And you say, "Yeah." They say, "Yeah, it's really sunny down there." You say, "All right, I'll try it." And then you go, boom, you know? Each one of us comes to experience whatever it is, okay, metaphysically, and you chose it. You absolutely chose it, okay? So then, if you look at the mindset, or the family, or the money, or the balance, or the sickness, or the disease, and you don't like it, tough. Because the very, very things that you do not like are those things that you're here to go beyond. The very things that worry you are the very things that you need to handle. The very weaknesses are the ones that are teaching you. Because I believe, and to wrap and pack this little sort of metaphysical resume, I believe that the way that we grow is we disengage ourselves from that light, we come into the physical plane, and we have a short period of time, and 70, 80 years metaphysically is not long, and we have this time to concentrate upon ourselves. Okay? And what we usually do is we work on strengthening ourselves, strengthening our identity, strengthening our feeling, and coming to these conclusions, most of which we will talk about today. Like, what is my purpose in life? You know, how do I feel about life? And you come basically to be in it. The way that you learn about emotion is you plunge in it. The way you learn about disease is to be in it. The way you learn about poverty is to do poverty. You know, anybody here done poverty? Right, stick your hands up, right. So you've done poverty, and there's a point in the doing poverty where you said, "This is the pits. This is totally revolting. This doesn't honor me." And you've stepped to moving into prosperity. The very fact that you gave up your day here, you know, and paid to come this for me, and you understand the stakes were in the hemisphere, they move on. We understand that we come to the same experience with you. And the very begin question as to, there's nothing that hasn't happened to you, where there's a number of lessons somewhere, you know? Whatever. So when you look at and you see how beautiful it is, then even more is stepping up, you're taking away 99% of the world. Israel is awful. Afghanistan and the communists, it's awful. What? And they say, there's a fight going here, this is awful. And they just flat out do not understand evolution. They don't understand it. The brain, and we will talk brain for the rest of the day probably, the brain acts as an inhibitor. It keeps you in the physical plane. If you didn't have a brain, you could take your consciousness out of the brain and you could perceive the dimensions that permeate physical reality. Within the physical plane are also dimensions that permeate it. Dimensions of basically the life force, dimensions of power, positivity, creativity, and dimensions of intense evil as well. Intense restriction, intense manipulation. Each one of us as humans, we drift into whatever sea of consciousness fits us. You just move in automatically, like birds of a feather flock together. Metaphysically, that is absolutely correct. And each one of you lives in a dimension of one kind or another. And it will change. But there's nothing stopping you moving into like dimensions of intense evil as any more than there is the ability for you to move into great positivity and great freedom and great empowerment and stand as a very strong person for your people. We have free will. And if you think about it, you couldn't possibly have a saint if you didn't have evil. How could you have it? Where would you judge the saint? And if you look in Taoism, the whole of Taoism is like that. It says that nothing is long or short. Because if I say to you it's a long walk, long in comparison to what? You know? If I say to you, this hat is very expensive, is it more expensive than buying a Concorde? Is it more expensive than, you know, the Sydney Harbour Bridge? What's it expensive more than? Well, it's more expensive than a cheaper hat. That's all. So when you look at money, you begin to understand that emotion puts the signposts or the guidelines in there. Okay? And as you look as becoming a mastery of money, and you look at the subliminal understanding of what life is, then bit by bit, we will constantly bring you back to looking at A, what do you believe? B, why the hell do you believe it? And C, who are you believing it for? Any belief that does not empower you, that does not free you, that does not honor you, that does not allow you the expression of this life force within you, is a belief that you just flat out don't need. So we're going to look at obligation, we're going to look at guilt, and we're going to look at the machinations of the ego, and watch how the ego constantly takes you from where you should be, downwards. That where you actually are is because of the manipulations of the ego. And you came into the physical plane, you have this holiness, you have this heroic energy inside of you, you're part of a very special group of energies that are here. A powerhouse of energy. And what rubbishes you into nothing is the mindset, the psyche of the people, the families, the belief patterns, and the ego. Once you understand that, you stand there and you go, my God. And you can see the unholiness that we bring into our lives. The manipulation that we use to get other people to do what we want. The manipulation that, for example, your family uses to get you to be what they want you to be. The manipulation that your husbands use to get you to be what he wants of you. The manipulation that the wives use to force the husband to do what they want him to do. The manipulation that the kids use to get the ice cream. And the manipulation that the mothers and fathers do to get the kids to do what they want to do. Because the kids are an image of the mother and father. And so if the kid wants to become a drug addict, that's no good, because the parents think that's no good. And so they manipulate him into being an architect. So he becomes a drug addict architect. Then we look at the manipulation of the society, the local government, the police force, the religious institutions. And then you look at the manipulation the media places upon you. Okay? And the media is a bit like having wide out family. Because the media insidiously gives you, subliminally, it gives you control and weakness all of the time. And we will discuss that. Then when you look at the psyche of the people, and because today is a day where we just mainly try to concentrate on money, you will watch on how people have a vested interest in making sure you don't do well. They will never flat out tell you that, but they have a vested interest in making sure you don't do well. Because if you become truly free, beyond fear, beyond manipulation, beyond restriction, if you became truly free, you could leave. And the last thing that the society ever wants you to do, the last thing the tribe ever wants you to do, the last thing the religion ever wants you to do, the last thing the family ever wants you to do, is leave. They don't want you to leave. They don't want you to leave. Why? Because they have fear. And because they are scared, they think that if you leave, they won't make it. They don't want you being bigger than the society, or bigger than the family, or not a part of it. If Uncle Joe empowers himself so much, he might disappear and go to Pogo Pango. What's that island out there in the Pacific?
Pango.
And never come back. You know? And what would become of us if Uncle Joe leaves? What would become of us if all of these idiots don't show up on Sunday and endorse this society, or this church, or this philosophy? How are we going to pay the rent? And then they begin to think of, well, how can we manipulate them to come? You know? What is the way to get them to come? And somebody says, they never say it, but they feel it, well, the best way to manipulate people is to scare them. If you scare them into coming, they'll come. If I told you that every one of you in this room were going to get cancer if you didn't come to my seminar, the seminar before, wouldn't it? And that's what I tell you, more or less. You're going to get eternal cancer if you don't show up on Sunday. Why? Because they want the strength and the security of the people around them. Now, you may be deeply involved in a religion, love the philosophy, love the teacher or the God force that brought it forward, and you can endorse the religion, okay? And you can be a part of it and support it and go there and get a lot out of it and sing the hymns and hers and love it. But you do so from choice, not because somebody says to you, if you don't, this bad thing's going to happen to you. The same way as you may love to wash the socks of the family and feel the freshness and the clean and feel good about the fact they look good going out and so on, but you do it from choice, not because you're being manipulated in it. It may be an honor to you to wash the dishes and to cook the food and to watch the nutrition and the health of your family as you are the provider of that, but you do it from choice. And so as we begin to look at how we are manipulated, and it's terribly hard, because it's terribly hard to watch and understand that we've fallen for it. The subliminal tapes that we sell have a track of music. And 40 decibels underneath this track are affirmations. The affirmations are put on a small loop, a 3-minute loop tape. And the loop goes round and round and round and round while the music's playing. Let's say this music is 60 minutes, okay? 40 decibels below the music is this loop. The loop has the affirmations. So, for example, in a tape like a sack of polished emeralds, it's an abundance tape, it has affirmations that deal with success, with feeling good, with action, with prospering, and so on, you know? Okay, setting up in the mind a feeling of like, I want to feel good. I feel good about wealth. I feel good about charging people. I feel good about my creativity, okay? That is heard by the brain, and it permeates the brain, and it, because the conscious mind cannot hear the affirmations, okay, it cannot say no. It cannot say making money's evil. It cannot say equal poverty for all. It cannot say, you know, I like being poor because people will love me that way. I like being poor because I don't have to do anything. You know, I like being poor because it's a nice, comfortable place. I enjoy stagnation. Okay? And so what happens... Now think of this before we wrap and pack the first introduction of today. If you can take in subliminal affirmations, proven, Pender, Becker, University of Portland, Oregon, Princeton University, and so on, if you can take in these affirmations at 40 decibels below ish, okay, what are you taking in right now that you don't know about? What is permeating your consciousness at this very second as you think you're sitting in a seminar listening to me, wondering when the break is, right? What is permeating your consciousness? What is permeating your consciousness when you're sitting at a bus stop? Yes, sir.
Sorry, I don't know about the bus stop, but I was going to say change to this question.
Well, change, yes, but also what is happening is you are leaving yourself open to an awful lot of debilitating thoughts. Okay? Because most people's thoughts are extremely debilitating, extremely detrimental. Okay? Because most people live in a very small hemisphere of influence. You know, they don't live in a wide open hemisphere of influence. They live in a little hemisphere of influence. And they say, this is what can be done. Only. And anybody that isn't in this hemisphere of influence, right, has got to be some kind of total scumbag. Because you're not supporting the people by being poor. If you're doing really well, that means you must be evil. You must have got it dishonestly somehow. You know? Why do they want to constantly snide remark the people that are doing well? It's a way of controlling them. Why does the media put down successful people? It's a way of controlling them. I was watching one of your bowlers being interviewed on TV when I first got here, and he seemed like he was a really neat bowler, and he'd been bowling these bowls for a long time and everybody liked it. And he was quite a heroic character, you know, like in the psyche of the people. He was like a top man and a good sport and everybody loved him, you know? And they said, well, what do you feel about the upcoming test series? Because you're a neat bowler and, you know, we want to know what you feel, you know? And he said, well, I'm sure I'll do quite well, he said. You know, I feel, yes, I think it'll all be all right, you know, but you never can tell what'll happen, you know? And he was talking, and the way he was talking was he was talking underneath the interviewer. At no time did the bowler ever want to say, look, I'm the best goddamn bowler in this country. Just leave it to me, I'll smash the hell out of him, you know? He couldn't say that. He had to pretend that he wasn't really very good, and if God liked him and loved him on the day, he might do okay. Alright? And as the interviewer endorsed this feeling with the bowler, you could watch the interviewer manipulate the bowler. Where the bowler felt that here he was on TV, if he felt too strong, people wouldn't love him. People would say he's a bullshit, egotistical bighead, and he isn't any good. And so he talked about himself, his image, his craft, in extremely derogatory ways. Saying, at no point did he say, I control the situation. You know? What he said was, I do not control the situation, I'm this humble little idiot, I'll accept you stomping all over me, okay? If I do really well, it'll be just good fortune and my mates helping me, and thank you for this opportunity to be so weak. And I watched this guy, and I watched how they manipulated him into not being okay. Then when he went out and bowled, he got 0 for 151. He never got a wicket. And they smashed him all over the park. They had teams of people to go get the balls back. They smashed him for 151 runs. But do you see? And all I'm going to ask you today is this, is not to rant and rave at the way they manipulate you, but to basically step out of it. Because you cannot change society in it. Well, you can, but it's the hard way. You know, you need to have the politics, placards, blah, 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 campaigns, you know, arguing, fighting, that kind of stuff. The way you change society is you withdraw from it. You withdraw from it, you stand aside, you stand strong, you create your belief patterns, your philosophy, your power, and then you return to the society. Okay? You never judge them, you never criticize them, you just stand strong. And folk come around you and they say, how come you're so strong? And you say, well, if you've got a minute, I'll be happy to tell you. And then you tell them, then you take them by the hand, you walk them outside their hemisphere of influence, you stick them out in the freedom, and you talk to them about freedom. About the bird flying at dawn across the rocks. About the beauty that there really exists. About what the love of man really means. About what abundance really, really means. There's not one person in this room I know that really has an idea of what true abundance is. And so, you don't have all that you really are entitled to. And remembering, because this force that we're talking about is free, is liberating, is non-judgmental, you can have as much as you can believe in. Can I ask you to believe in more? Yes. Can I be involved in whether you do or don't? No. But I'm going to ask you. I'm going to refuse to let you out of this room until you at least consider more. And understand that more does not make you evil. And the people who say more makes you evil are trying to manipulate you into not having more. Because they don't want you to leave because they're scared. That's all. When you understand that, you just create more. You just take it, you make it, and you don't flaunt it. You just keep quiet about it. You stay within your own world. You will find that if you begin to work with some of these principles, the people around you will change. And some of you have already experienced that, have you not? The people around you will change. Why? Because as you raise your energy, you'll begin to drift into other dimensions. Now, when you get into those other dimensions, you'll be the new girl or the new boy on the block, so to speak, as I would say in American. He's the new guy on the block. You'll be the new guy on the block. And you'll be the new guy on the block, so it'll feel uncomfortable. It'll feel difficult. It'll feel like, hey, I know at this moment, right here, right now, I'm penetrating my comfort zone. I'm penetrating and expanding the hemisphere of influence. It feels uncomfortable, but I accept this because I know I'm growing. Metaphysically, spiritually, financially, emotionally, intellectually, I'm growing, so I'm prepared to push, okay? All right, as you begin to move up, you'll begin to penetrate your comfort zone, you'll penetrate into other dimensions, and the people in those dimensions will be ready and waiting for you to join them. Because there are people in this world that live in a consciousness that is so high that if you spend 15 minutes with you, it'll totally change your life. You can find them. And all you have to do is to begin to meet them is to start moving up. You see, what happens to the human condition is we feel ourselves stagnated, we feel ourselves lowly down here somewhere, and we say, I hope maybe someday somewhere a millionaire will find me and I will be selected. Okay? Anybody here, and I want you to be honest, I'm not going to ridicule you, but anybody here ever felt that they were waiting to be discovered? Look at you, look at that! Right, like you're waiting to be discovered, like one day, someday, this geezer from the record company is going to like knock me over at the stop sign and pick me up and just say, oh, I found you, you're the one. All right. When we watch the stupidity of the ego, we watch also and we understand, well, what's the way out of that? The way to be discovered is to begin to climb, to begin to raise your energy, to begin to become action-oriented, to begin to become like this creativity powerhouse, to have something to offer. I know lots and lots and lots of millionaires, bundles of them. And whenever you hang out with these guys and these ladies, they have one thing in common. They do not scoodle around looking for people to discover. They don't. What they do is, they say, let us go to the Rangoon Racquet Club for lunch. And you get in their jet and you sit there in the little jet and they take you to this racquet club and you have lunch. And in the racquet club, because the racquet club costs $200 for two for lunch, the only people sitting having lunch are other millionaires, or at least very wealthy, very creative people. And they live in a dimension of wealth, and everybody lives in the same place. It's a fact. So if you're looking to be discovered, hanging out where you hang out, down at a local pub on the corner, forget it. You know, you're moving out of a consciousness where the people are, and you're moving into another consciousness. And we're looking at it from a metaphysical, mystical point of view of saying, hey, it's all very well to have money. Having money doesn't make you holy. I mean, I know some of the biggest turds in the world who got money. They're horrible. I mean, they're evil. The point about what we're looking at is we're looking to make plenty of money, but to have like a kind of godliness or a purpose in the money, a life force. So you could say, hey, I made all this money, but I used it to empower the people. Who did I empower? Well, the very first person you have to empower is you. So the whole point of you making money is for you. Okay, you're not making money to save the world, to send money to Ethiopians, to put your kids through college, to get a vasectomy for the cat, or whatever. Right, first thing, look after your people around, your family and your loved ones. Then you can go on to the societies, the associations, the churches. You can send $10,000 to the cricket association or whatever you want to do, and you're going to look beyond yourself. But one of the problems is that we have small hemispheres of influence, and we think, because we're sold this bill of goods, we're sold stuff, we have to do it with us. And who were the people that told us we had to do it for the others? Yeah, the others. Yeah. You see how it works? So they have a vested interest in telling you that. They're not doing it out of naughtiness, but they subliminally can feed you that garbage because they know it works. In America, the phenomenon of television over the last five years, has been the ministries, the church ministries on television, okay? I mean, money-making, money-generating ministries like you wouldn't believe. There's one called the 700 Club. And it has a turnover of $240 million a year. Okay? Now, we're not going to look at that and say it's evil, but you watch the way, for them to get $240 million worth of money, they have to transfer $240 million worth of emotion. There's no other way of doing it. You cannot have a TV show and say, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoy this show. I hope it's been informative. I hope you've come to understand the Bible better, the philosophies of the Nazarene. I hope this empowers your family and your community. And whatever you do, under no circumstances, send us any money. Okay? As much as you might like to just right at this very second send us a check, please don't do that. If you send us a check, we will mail it back to you. So do not send us any cash at all. They can't run the ministries like that. So what they do is this, right up 5 minutes before the show's over, they take a clip out of the library of a bunch of little black kids in Africa running around looking skinny, okay? And they say, please send us some money for these black kids that look skinny. And people send it in their millions. Then what the church does If they take in $7 million, they send a quarter of $1 million to one of the agencies who administer it. They take out $50,000-$60,000 for administering it. Some official in Ethiopia takes out another 50 grand because he's there in the docks. And maybe 100 or 110 grand or 120 grand gets to the skinny little kids. But less than 1%, 2% at the most. So if I could give you a shot, if I could put up a video here and give you 10 minutes of skinny little kids, right, and charge you 60 bucks to come to a seminar and send the skinny kids 5 bucks, I'd do it, wouldn't I? What a piece of merchandising. So when you watch the way they use emotion, you can look at that and you can say, well, this is evil. It's manipulative. It's totally horrendous that they're doing this. Or you could say, I don't want to be a part of that. I do not want to be a part of it. I can watch the show, I can get the information, but I ain't sending any money for the skinny kids because I know it's not going on the skinny kids. Jimmy Swaggart, $70 million. Jerry Falwell, $105 million. Praise the Lord Ministries from North Carolina, $140 million. All transfer of emotion. All dealing with guilt, obligation, and here's, how can you watch a film of a lot of little skinny kids in the dirt and not feel bad about it? You know, you look at it, you think, my God, look at those little skinny kids, you know? And when you watch that kind of manipulation, you understand that we have options. That we have options. We do not judge the ministries and say these people are evil. We do not judge the philosophies or the religions or the societies or the media and say these people are evil. All we say is, because of the weakness of the human condition, people cannot ask for what they want. So they have to manipulate each other to get what they want. They cannot say, come for dinner and I'd like to make love. So they manipulate you into bed. Okay, through some incredible gyrations. And haven't you tried that? Or experienced that? What we look at in the mastery of our lives and what we're going to look at today is in trying to deal with people out of total fairness. If you have a TV show and you need $7 million to keep it going, you should get up and say, I need you to send me $7 million to keep this dumb show going. And if they don't send you the $1 million, you get off the air. You see, but we can't do that. And the ministries can't do that. They can't be honest. And I'm going to ask you today, without feeling uncomfortable, but as an impartial observer of your own life, to look and see whether or not you give the world and the loved ones and your workers and your mates and your pals, whether you give them the skinny kid approach or whether you tell them the truth. You know, whether you give them the dinner and dance or whether you tell them the bloody truth. I'm trying to get you into bed. How do you feel about it? More than likely, they'll probably say, that's fine. Let's just go to bed and never mind the dinner and dance. That's a great idea. That's actually what I want to do. Because it is my contention, ladies and gentlemen, and it's my experience, and I've seen people exactly like yourselves prove it over and over and over again, hundreds of thousands of them, that if you get clear about what you want, you work with these things that we're talking about today, you can actually ask people for what you want and you'll get it. You'll be amazed, but you'll get it. I want $4 an hour more. Fine. I want, and they'll give it to you. I want you to buy me a dishwasher because I don't do dishes. All right? I have a dishwasher. I want, and they will do it for you. But what happens is we have a tendency to think that if we ask for what we want, one, we're bothering the people, two, they're going to reject us. And the ego lives in this incredible, incredible fear of rejection. And that's why salesman and salesmanship is such a powerful metaphysical journey. When you look at a traveling salesman, he's given a bum rap, you know, he's always sort of painted as this sleazy guy, you know, like having these sexual affairs and never coming home and, you know, broom handle, sort of foot in the door, body encyclopedia kind of energy. But in fact, salesmanship is one of the greatest metaphysical tests you'll ever face. Because you deal with self-image, love of self, you deal with organization. You have to have the product, you have to understand it, it has to be a good product. You have to understand emotion, because you cannot sell anything to anybody if you cannot create or stir within them an emotion. Okay? That is the first part of selling, is you have to sort of tickle their emotion. Okay? You have to sell them an emotion. This candy tastes good. That's an emotion. This seminar will double your income and change your life. There's an emotion. I don't want to double my income and change my life. Fine, don't come. But there's the emotion. You know, here's the little skinny kid, send the money, okay? When you can do that, then the very next thing the salesperson deals with is rejection. And the ego lives in horror of being rejected. Because the whole raison d'etre of the ego is that it develops a lifestyle where people like it. Do you love me? Do you like me? Do you accept me? I will do anything. I mean, lie down and I'll fan you, just as long as you like me, you know? And so, as we look, what you have, your creativity, and the things that you're beginning to develop from within yourself, at some point somewhere, you've got to translate it from energy into money, and money is basically another form of energy, okay? And when you make that transfer, you're going to have to deal with them rejecting it. You're going to have to be able to deal with people coming up to you saying, I don't want your hairdressing. I don't want your candy. I don't want your taxi. I don't want your computer service. And I don't want whatever. Okay, when you understand that you don't care if they want it or don't want it, you begin to step one more step away. You subliminally put yourself away from the transaction. And when your ego is not in the transaction, what do you get? You get the transaction. When you do not need to buy the building, you get it. When you do not need for the guy to show up on Saturday night, he rings you. It's always the same. So we're going to look at remembering constantly what people think of you is none of your business. None at all. What people think of me is nothing to do with me. And you have to be careful not to take that on in a kind of sort of combative way where you say, well, I don't care what they think of me. That isn't what we're looking at. What we're saying is, I honor your decision, whatever that might be about me. I honor your life. I honor who you are. But what you think about me is not part of my hemisphere of influence and does not guide what I'm going to do next. Okay, what I'm going to do next is take a 20-minute break. I don't care what you think about it. Okay? If one of you decides to take a 22-minute break, that's fine by me. You'll miss 2 minutes of the next lecture. But my decision to take a 20... You know, do you see how we're working? We're beginning to look at, as you begin to develop the creativity, at some point you're going to have to sell it. When you sell it, you're going to have to be good and feel good about charging for it. When you charge for it, that's going to be great. Sometimes they're going to say no. And you can never know why they said no. And when they say no, you've got to not take it personal. Okay, let us take